five, six.
Oh, boy.
You're on the air.
I'm on the air. Tommy's there speaking about the romantic self. Yeah, I want to talk about the food story in general and something about saving the self in the process. It began with a number of insights that came to me rather painfully, but one was attending the Overeaters Anonymous, kind of a low point in my life. And I think I'll read a little bit of that to you. And at the same time, helping a friend at Alcoholic Anonymous, which I attended as a kind of help. And being so struck by the difference between the dialogue that was going on there, and a sense that people who are involved with food are hiding a story from themselves. That while they can be very cocky and very involved in the very explanations of why they eat or why they don't eat, or they get sick around food, the guilt and so forth, that whole kind of pathos of eating. And in fact, that's an overt tale. And if there's a hidden tale beneath that, it's not being spoken of. So I'm going to read a little bit of this to you, just a few pages to get you started. And then I think I'll really throw it open and then throw in a whole these nice phrases, which of course I'm a little probably over fond. And I'll start off with a couple quotes. One is from Agathias in his Greek mythology in the 6th century. And this is a poem, the last couple lines I'm quoting to you. What a fool. Then was the time to think of it when you lay most hog-like, gorging at the table, in love with your own capacity. And this is Georges Bataille, The Notions of Expenditure. I think that's a 1930 something. The immense travail of recklessness, discharge, and upheaval that constitutes life could be expressed by stating that life starts only with a deficit for these systems. At least what it allows in the way of order and reserve has meaning only that moment when the ordered and reserved forces liberate and lose themselves for ends that cannot be subordinated to anything anyone can accomplish. It is only by such insubordination, even if it is in college, that the human race ceases to be isolated in the unconditional splendor of material things, the glory that sums up or symbolizes without exhausting, the object of free expenditure, cannot be distinguished from the insubordinate characterization which is the condition for everything else. That probably is hard to untangle, but we get it. Are you familiar with Bataille's argument about expenditure? He's really talking about those aspects of society which seem to him never to be accounted for in anything like the utilitarian argument. War, games, potlatch. And he begins to argue against the fascist and the orderization of modern life in terms of that irreconcilable, unaccountable aspect of the human dimension that loves to expend freely as a gesture of the self. And a kind of universal potlatch. And claims that's inherent in the meaning of all social organization. That you cannot no matter kind of ordering or organization of society can ever eliminate the irrational component of our need to extend life recklessly and give up the self in an unaccountable way. He sat swinging his knees together because the fat forced them apart. As barn door might, the swinging fodder had been piled up too hard against the wind. With him was a woman, a lesser figure, and a chastened member of the group. They were holding hands, less it seems to share or display affection than to hold him down. For despite his enormous size, one could imagine that he was about to leap for the door in some great need. To eat, apparently. He couldn't, he said, go for but a few minutes without eating. This from a voice hidden away in greasy folds that sounded all the world like men and women. And when his turn came to share, quote unquote, his fast gumption still didn't obscure his commanding sentences. He was a novelist and a success, making good money in sports writing. He then left. Another member was as spectacularly divided inside from out. She would have to sit with her legs straight up, for they were too thick to bend. Over these legs, she would keep adjusting her skirts if she caught anyone's eyes. One had to look up from her feet to her face, which pushed a small oval far away on top of the mountain that was her body, a face so kind, lost out there. She was soft brown in color with a northern, much educated man. Her story was about her fear over a young man who had come to live with her, some kind of addict, the tragic kind. who now wanted to be her lover. Could she handle it, she argued with herself. No cross-speaking is allowed at these Overeaters Anonymous meetings. After all, she was the top head of her department, in charge of many women. She knew how strong she could be. She never mentioned punching, though the distance between her voice and her body forbade courage. One could have imagined her being a princess on the peak of a glass of scent, waiting for a long time. There were several there in this village church OEA meeting who thought themselves almost beauty and good reason, and several hopelessly fed men who had lost weight permanently, traveling. These men liked to talk of their newfound social ease without being convincing. One would, for example, throw out accusing stares as he cataloged the many jobs he was getting for his cartoons. The other self-congratulatory type suffered from a Christian goodwill and pudding blandness. He grotesquely if he wasn't sharing a meeting with his insipid platitudes. Indeed, he chaired it out so often, I thought at first he was hired to do so by the OBA. It was his glory and our defeat, all us satisfied him. He was now chairing when Vicky walked in. Rhonda was an editor who affected a city smart girl wisdom, and he, I think I missed the sentence up. Whose one most insistent fantasy was to be a genius. She was tall and unspelt and complained of cookie gobbling on lonely nights, whole bags of Pepperidge Farm. The same amount my film students eat during one class. Do I make them lonely, or do I make them wish they were geniuses? Vicky, perhaps not yet in her 20s, had cream skin, black hair, and face Caravaggio with a floor. Peasant, round, floridly satchel, and fine enough in detail to make you reach for your brush. The same figure of Rubens' young bride. She had been crying, and she was too upset to wait the rounds of formalities before sharing. I want to dance, she began. I hate my boyfriend, I'm going to kill myself. And between sobs and grasping her soul, she told the hospital and other suicide attempts of her boyfriend wrecking the music they composed together, using her and cheating her, of the male sex who was to blame for war and pollution, of desperate evil binges. Rhonda tried turning her words back on her therapy over the protests of the platitudes slinger, that reflection was against the rules. Soon Rhonda and the platitudes slinger were quarreling nastily over the conduct of the meeting. Others hush-hushed and there as best they could. Vicky sucked back a few drafts of shame for having caused trouble, apologized and then went back to her broken heart. Let her cry it out seemed to be the general intelligence as the meeting broke up. I found myself often on the verge of tears in these meetings, too supercilious to confess, too sorry for everyone else's fat pain. What was before me, despite all that self-help, this works enthusiasm, was the depth where fat people hurt, incomprehensible. It's there, down past the self-loathing and humiliation, their inept defenses against attack, blocking of the body, past the last residues of pluck down to the core of pathos, where the mouth would take in the mother and can't, where the world should be turned off and doesn't. Fat children are embarrassment, they are usually tortured, fat adults wear the evidence of self-abuse, no matter how convincingly they display their talents. Their fat speaks for the child in them who feeds. Don't be mean. Look at the egg I'm trying to fill. That look may be read differently. I'm going to skip some of this. I didn't realize how long it goes on. I came to understand that I wanted others to speak out. To my surprise, what I had to acknowledge in these meetings was anger. True, the pathos had caught me up, but it soon felt operational. There had to be some conviction in these people underneath the self-pity. They were too powerful in life. I became angry at the hypocrisy of their, my lament, though it might be very hard to discover in the absence of stories that so mark fat sufferers. And by that, people including, you know, the whole range of fat sufferers, people who diet perpetually, whether they're skinny or fat or perfectly normal. Those people who engage in the same effort that makes the rituals around beauty relatively unimportant. Those disciplines around saving and expenditures for the sake of the admired body. Once the lessons of appetite, habit, calorie exercise are fairly reversed, once it is re-shown that demoralized states are closed-off worlds that we can be lifted out of, often with surprising ease, once all those obvious tales are dispensed with, the deeper stories of ambitions and fantasies were missing. I have noticed this in the same girl from those who talk about anorexia and those who talk for it. The lament of those who make their bodies metamorphose has a profound core, but the profundity itself reinforces the specialness that they've already arrogated to themselves. Privately, this is still a private country, most privately. I've come to understand that I wanted others to speak out, just these themes I had played out with myself, and I speak out for them. Now I want to talk about Alcoholics Anonymous, because I want to pair the two meetings and use that to explain some of the things. I must admit that the thought of the glorious delusion surrounding obesity did not congeal in the OEA meetings. They were too sad and defeatist, even when the person speaking was telling me it was for a cure. Some groups do concentrate on weight loss, like Weight Watchers, and the applause for the big loser is part genuine and admired. But in one exercise I recall, we were asked to tell the person seated next to us what our accomplishments were. Not one dared risk exposure of the grand self within. Quite the contrary, each miserably reduced him or herself. One woman, a lawyer, heaved a sigh and offered she thought that she treated her friends well. For what, we might ask, to fit into the new person each was there to become. When 95% of dieters return to the same old person after 5 years, this realm of the new self must be a letdown. I have come to believe that the stories of these fat people and not-so-fat people are mislaid in these groups, but only after using out a few AA meetings that I attended. OEA is patterned after AA, a similar source, similar programs and steps, which asks one to search for and make up the personal failings via these others. All under the guidance of a higher power. The addictive personality, and I'm going to talk to you about why this is finally a complaint about, against explanation, and particularly against the language of addiction and substance abuse, which I would like to dispense with altogether. The addictive personality in the system suffers from guilt, but you would never know it from these teller of tales. Alcoholics cure themselves, and that's a quote. Note that they refuse to give up the identity of the alcoholic. By reinventing heroic storytelling each night, night after night, as if they were drawn by the campfire to brag before the Athenians languishing in the fields around Troy. They begin by introducing themselves by first names only, then by tribe. Hi, my name is Pete, and I'm an alcoholic. One member then begins a long story, as much as an hour, if I remember correctly, of his or her life as an alcoholic. The rise of the disease, the terrible bottoming out, the personal salvation, and with this opportunity, the chance to save others. What was remarkable was the ill-concealed joy with which they recalled their adventures under the influence. How charged the air, the roars of approval they got for some particularly outrageous misdeed. Their stories were painful and some did begin shakily, yet appreciation was so strong the speakers warmed heartily for themselves. Shame, not guilt, turned to happy chagrin, then to serious amusement. As the part about the bottom came, everybody in the room grew somber. At the salvation, everyone pitched back in deep satisfaction. What they clearly preferred, though, was the drunken experts. Some members couldn't hide their restlessness when a young woman tried to make her sitting room confrontation with alcohol be as exciting as the men's punching the sheriff, drag-racing the cops, offending the world kind of stories. Some got up to leave. It was the only moment I felt sorry for anybody in the sermon that sitting was there. They are saving themselves, I thought then, by recovering a romantic self in a postmodern society in which narratives have become tame, self-conscious, evolving, and never uninterrupted. They save themselves in a manner that preserves their status as special, pitched against an old lover whom they look on with a campaigner's affection, in the bosom of their comrades, lovers' tales, warriors' tales, heroes' tales. It was fun, moreover it was sexy. They complained about the sexiness in fact. The worst thing that could happen to a myth therapist tell them is to give in to the attraction to alcoholics have for each other. And what are they attracted to? The danger in the living, the desperado. Once one of a very pretty young woman from the Overeater Anonymous, from Overeaters came in, OEA types can attend if they consider themselves quote unquote cross-addicted, or maybe cross-addicted. Most knew her, and they didn't hide their throw the bum out consensus very well. I think I understood. Who wanted a fat person, in this case not at all fat persons, pathos, spoiling everyone's charge? One more point. As much as the rhetoric of guilt and judgment were there in the foreground, as much as some tried psychological explanation for their experience, there was that sense that this obsession needed no accounting for. At this I'm probably using up my meeting talking, but I wanted to start off with the sense of the experience. I want to share with you two more that I've had recently, and which I think encapsulates the contours of the problems we experience it now. I was in a locker room 2 days ago, and I heard two young women say to each other, I wrote it down, but something to the effect, well, haven't you noticed that when you have a great boyfriend, you don't eat? And, you know, and the other one said something, yeah, it's true. And it's the jerks who always make you eat. And then the one said, you know, I've just fallen in love, and I haven't eaten a thing for 3 days. And I said, when I fell in love, I had 2 muffins and 5 days. And that's, you know, that's a story that I've heard repeated so often, that young women today are actually measuring, they've got a quantitative measure for their experience of love, and it's about food. They've actually, reduced their whole sense of romantic love into, you know, a very quantitative and compartmentalized explanation. The other side of the food story that I think is particularly current and scary is the nutritionist craze. And at my Thanksgiving dinner table, I saw 4 men begin to brag, like the dozens, play a game with each other about abstinence and the vitamins that they needed. And it became, you know, who could outdo who in terrorizing each other about the contaminating process of food, you know, the caffeine, the pollutants and meats, and the sugar, you know, so forth. And they managed to brag to each other about the various feelings of abstinence and prohibition that they had started. And who was reading more diet newsletters, you know, who was latest aficionado, and so forth. I've seen the same thing happen among women who are now being treated by the so-called nutritionists, who have another, it's different for women. They tend less to brag about each other in a kind of competitive fashion about their abstinences. But the happiness that they express under these various regimes is that they're losing weight because their nutritionist has told them that they now have a food addiction or a food allergy. And therefore they can give up or a candida infection or something that, you know, is universalized and releases them from all guilt, the disease. And therefore they can go on these horrendously restrictive regimes, no meat, no sugar, no carbohydrates, et cetera, et cetera, and tell you quite happily that for the first time in their life they don't have a weight problem. They have no compulsion towards food. Because they've been able to sublimate in this kind of absurdist fashion their anxiety around food into their anxiety about purity and disease. So I think something universal is happening among, you know, a crisis coming in the 70s and 80s around self that, you know, has been focused on young women and which she is taking the greater burden, probably because of the very things that George Eliot was speaking about for so long, that indefiniteness of women's lives, right, that blundering self to which we are all prone. And I know we've used I know I just told you I was going to pose this as a question and then blog. All right, so hold on, I will in a minute. All right, 5 more minutes. I'll do 5 more minutes. I'm going to say something a little bit about Bakhtin and the Thai and their explanations of self, but I wrote a paragraph about what I thought was going on in the romantic self. There's a way in which the romantic self, in Blake's beautiful phrase, that the road to excess led to the palace of wisdom, that sense of expending yourself in excessive ways, right, in order to find something that placed you above the quotidian, above the middle class quotidian, because that was safe and orderly, predictable and reasonable. That sense of throwing yourself out into the world in order to be a guide into the future, to a warrior in the wilderness, has been delimited in modern life into the sense of abuse. Anyone who seeks to, you know, who expends too much becomes a credit card abuser. Right? Anyone who seeks power in their life becomes a power abuser. So there's now books out about love addiction. There's no more Byronic self, there's the love addict. or you know, there's no more sense of the sexual expenditure in terms of the enormity or the grandiosity of self. There's only that dread that you have, you know, you've gone off from the center. Right? You've left the center body of safeness. Right? You've given up something that holds the center together. And dangerous, and this is no longer attractive fashion. We have, now, the romantic self is never easily incorporated in any society. It's always the out there. It's always on the other side. But this particular society has developed new explanations for it around abuse and addiction. And I've warned you that this is, a bad effort on a lot of people's parts to bring you back into the lesser relationship to yourself. Now, to quickly summarize a whole lot of things that I wanted to say, was that this kind of poverty of explanation that we have defies the experience that I think most people, most women especially, since this is largely a women's problem, we do have to confront that. That bulimia and anorexia and obesity is still largely a women's problem. It's still largely something that's centered on the middle class woman. And it's peculiarly American, interestingly enough. So anorexia and bulimia has appeared in other countries, it doesn't have the same quality as the American. For one thing, there's very little, if you follow some of the other readings on the subject, there's very little shift between obesity and anorexia. In this country, it's quite common. So we really are talking about something that's current, that's about ourselves, and we have to be careful how universalizing and this dialogue. But I think that there's a moment in childhood that when not only do we begin to perceive all those things that Susie Orbach and the rest of them have talked about. The confronting of ourselves as mature women, as sexual women, and the crisis around that, those terrible painful years of self-consciousness, we call adolescence, where most food stories begin. Prior to that, there's another kind of story. But the ones in which we begin to take responsibility for ourselves as adults, begin to identify our own roles in making our bodies, comes about that time. It's also a kind of powerful idealization, which is something that the Freudians and the utilitarians and the feminist unfortunately do not talk about. Right? It's about that kind of fantasy of self. It's about the kind of wanting to save the world, or wanting to be great, or wanting to be sublime. Right? Not just beautiful, but sublime. Now, I'm using kind of old language here, and it's right out of the 18th century, but the Romantics had an argument about the sublime. They knew, for example, that the order was straight and beauty was smooth and even, small and delicate, never deviated too much from the sense of proportion or evenness, but the sublime was grandiose, rugged and dark and full of dimensions and terrifying. I think that the adolescent girl experiencing that is a complex quite differently than most adolescent girls. There's no role for them to play, a temporary outward role that allows them to think of that grandiose self actually in the world. And I go through what I think are the typical kinds of representations that we've all experienced, and which tends to be a perennial subject at such conferences. The agony over the loss of representation of this form of self is just not there. It's not in photographs, it's not in movies, it's not in literature, it's not in our parents, it's not in our mothers. Right, there's no place for that dark, the terrific, the messianic, the potential of self to be played out. One of my explanations for food is that it changes the shape of your body. And you begin to play out on your body a kind of demonic role with body changing. And that the experience of obesity and thinness, most fat people and most anorexic people experience 30, 40, 50 pound shifts in weight. And extraordinary kinds of revolutions of self around the ability to essentially change the self as it's outwardly flavored. And since food now is really a choice, I mean, since we are in that curious place in our human history that we constantly have to choose how we eat rather than being presented to how we eat, we're actually choosing loves. What I think is happening is that the sublime self has become an inner experience completely because it can't be played out anymore. It has no kind of real drama, no projects to see, so you see as a substance instead, and you become, in fact, substance obsessed and body obsessed, but particularly obsessed around metamorphosis, about changing. And if you listen to the stories the stories that fat people and bulimic and anorexic talk about is the story of the horror around shifting bodies, which is also, of course, the excitement of the sickening itself. What they don't talk about is the very fantasies of actually being able, actually acting, actually having a project. Now, I also noticed in one woman that how often people who are caught up in projects, even projects of mourning, for example, or projects of creativity, usually have little or no food problem. It tends to disappear, which is one of the reasons that the love project now has become seized upon as another way not to have to worry about food. But it's come back to us in such reduced forms.
Wait, could you repeat that? I didn't quite catch what you said about creativity.
I just think that those moments when you're vigorously working on something and kind of taken up by a project, I've noticed in myself and I've noticed in so many other people that food just becomes then what it is, either a chance to relax and talk or because you're hungry or something. But the obsession with food tends to dissipate.
Oh, okay. I wasn't sure whether you were saying that anorexics weren't created, that it was an either or, because my experience has been that a large majority of anorexics are also highly creative.
What has struck me about anorexia over the person who suffers obesity is that the ambition is right up front. And once the project is seized upon, then you're sort of driven almost mechanically past the point and use that sense of lightness, of being free from certain kinds of restraints, to keep you charged. There are many designers who deliberately starve themselves for 2 or 3 days in order to achieve a certain high, in order to and to feel that kind of inner energy that you get from being passed by. It's an incredible high, in fact, and self-induced. Where the fat person tends to be so buried around their ambitions, or so incapable of making them visible, and allowing other people to see them. That certainly was the truth in the stories here. They could talk about the pain, they couldn't talk about their success, their accomplishments. And often what I tried to show is that success and accomplishments were very real. But the fat is actually a way of saying I can dissociate myself from my own fantasies and ambitions. So the anorexic has discovered that the ambition can be right at home, can be almost transparent. And also the excitement around, the very excitement of the thrill that you, the high, this metabolic high that you get.
Do you mind if I'm a little confused?
Okay.
Do you mind if I ask? What I'm not quite clear about is that my experience from women I've known and from myself in the past has been that after a certain point, the anorexia interferes with creativity, that a way of working out of the anorexia often will be, creative, but that after a certain point, the creativity stops with anorexia in the same way. Yeah, so that and that the creativity is played out in the physical expression of the anorexia rather than, say, through painting or writing.
My argument is you have to stop making the body as a place.
Yeah. I just wanted to make sure. Yeah. We're saying the same thing.
That the sublimation can't be through nutrition or center of body.
Yeah.
It's got to be out of the body and into the drama that the film
can be. And into a world that puts so much focus on the body.
Yeah.
Well, do you think bodybuilding is being made part of that memoir? My perception is that I'm seeing as much of an obsession with that kind of
analysis
about eating disorder and eating
disorder. I mean, all you have to do is this. Oh. Yeah, look at this. I didn't used to have this.
I saw a young woman who said she was a weightlifter and was weighing 180 pounds. Come into the shower, I got a good look at it, and she didn't weigh 110. And she had decided to change from weightlifting to bodybuilding, body sculpting.
Mm-hmm.
And within the course of a year, completely changed her whole athletic routine.
Mm-hmm.
And in order to reshape the body, yes, I think there's incredible fascination with that control over
I think
and
that
metamorphizing of the body. Yeah.
It's another, it's funny, but it goes back to the whole question of spirituality, too, which you brought up earlier, talking about how spirituality is deemed in a woman, which historically that's not true. It's always been that male has been the spiritual holder. And biblically, even in the Old Testament, we look at, and the references are that God doesn't keep a woman's promises unless it's witnessed by man, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Somehow, I think
that's a Jewish tradition. There's a lot in Christianity about women. I mean,
the Greek classical tradition of women always had control over their religion. They virtually dominated.
But I think in America we have not held that. I mean, I think that women have held that amongst women that we're spiritual holders, but I think our society at large has. I'm just wondering how that transition occurred, but. Anyway, just coming back to the bodybuilding thing, I mean, I think it's another way of, again, I think it's a way of creating our maleness in society and creating that physical power, which then physical molding also becomes our presentational, if you like, spiritual molding as well.
Well, I think, just, I want to say something. I don't think you're ever going to get out of this.
Yeah.
You live with a body. And what I think it's very important to see is that you choose your body. There's this wonderful phrase that at 25 you're responsible for your face. Well, you know, there is that sense that part of coming to realization of life is coming to realization that you have formed your body. You have the sadness, your creative sense, your humor, it's all written into your body somehow. We know this. As soon as we're 12 or 13, and you look around the adult world and you're in 12 or 13, you are a profound critic of the adult world. And you know, you begin to realize that there you know, people make choices, wrong choices, right choices, and that fascination with choice,